You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hi, everybody. I hope you can hear me. I'm David Kippen. We'll wait just a few minutes in case anybody's stuck in traffic. Anybody out there laughing? If you thought that was funny, please text LOL to 310-924-9821. We're here to listen to a conversation between the LA Times staff writer, Carolina Miranda, and the author of the new book, Becoming Los Angeles, Myth, Memory, and a Sense of Place, DJ Waldy. I've known and admired Carolina Miranda for years, but this morning I asked her for a bio, and she did something I definitely planned to steal. After she told me that anything I said would be just fine, just to make it easy on me, she emailed me three bios. One was 148 words, one was 84 words, and the shortest was 64. In the interest of time, here's the 84-worder. Carolina Miranda is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, where she covers culture with a focus on art and architecture. Prior to this, she was a longtime independent journalist, contributing stories to Time Magazine, Art News. Somebody just hit LOL, very merciful. Fast Company, Architect, Art in America, and National Public Radio. And KCET, all those two probably. She's a regular contributor for KCRW's Press Play and a winner of the 2017 Rabkin Prize in Visual Arts Journalism. She served as founding co-chair of the Los Angeles Times Guild, the Los Angeles Times Employee Union, for the first time in a long three-digit time since the 1860s. Okay, now I can knock those 84 words down to a dozen or so. Carolina Miranda is so talented, she could write about anywhere for anybody, but she chooses to write about LA for us, and thank heaven for it. And by the way, Carolina has added to her bio, and I quote, "You may want to note that I am powered by sunshine and burritos," unquote. Both renewable resources, I might add. Now, I've known and admired Don Waldy even longer than I've known Carolina, but his wonderful publisher, Angel City Press, whose book by Linnell George about Octavia Butler I can't wait to see later this year, Angel City sent me a bio of Don too. Like Carolina's, the bio of Don that Angel City sent is too short to do him justice. Unlike Carolina's, though, Angel City's bio for Don is 1,373 words long, so I may have to slenderize it a bit, as follows. The New York Times has called DJ Waldy a writer whose work is, quote, "a gorgeous distillation of architectural and social history," unquote, whose essays and memoirs, said the Los Angeles Times, not to be outdone, quote, "conjure the idiosyncratic splendor of Southern California life," unquote. He's the author of the acclaimed book Holy Land, a suburban memoir, which I have not only read but loved, taught, very indirectly helped to publish when I was at Buzz Magazine, and even tried to get translated into Chinese. Don's other books include Where We Are Now, Notes from Los Angeles, also from Angel City Press, and also indispensable for anybody hoping to understand our city. And I might add that Becoming Los Angeles isn't the only new book about LA this summer. I count at least three, of which I reviewed, maybe a little bit cruelly, in the Los Angeles Times this month, another. But Don's is easily the best of them. I can't wait to hear what he and Caroline have to say. Oh, and one last thing. The Library Foundation provides vital support to the Los Angeles Public Library. Deep, deep thanks to all of you members tuning in tonight. The rest of you Maroons, please visit lfla.org and join. And also to see what other exciting programs the library has coming up this fall. And now I'm going to do what many of my fellow Angelinos have been wanting to do for years, which is mute me so that somebody else can get a word in edgewise. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, David. I feel like I now need to live up to that introduction that you have delivered. So thank you so much. Don, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm beyond excited to be able to hang out and chat with you this evening about the new book, because I just want to share, before we get started, I want to share a small anecdote, which is that when Holy Land came out, I was still living on the East Coast, and I came to visit an old high school teacher of mine with whom I remained good friends until he passed away earlier this year. And I remember specifically the evening that I went to his house, and we would talk about books and carried from Mexico City to an anonymous stretch of riverbank by Colonel Felipe de Neve, governor of California. The grid the Spanish colonel carried to the non-existent Los Angeles in 1781 originally came from a book in the archive of the Indies in Seville. The book prescribed the exact orientation of the streets, the houses, and the public places for all the colonial settlements in the Spanish Americas. That grid came from God. And that book, which he gave to me, I feel like was a life changer in terms of how I thought about Los Angeles, especially every time I drive over Hoover, which is that demarcation point.
Exactly.
Between Spanish and English. So I'm very excited to be here today to talk about the new one. So I wanted to start with, you know, the first book was published some time ago now, I believe in the 1990s. How has your view of Los Angeles evolved during that time between writing Holy Land and sitting down to work on becoming Los Angeles?
Well, I've learned a great deal more about Los Angeles. I've delved more deeply into its 19th century history, which is perhaps the least well-known part of what it means to be an Angelino. And I've thought a great deal about the major issue in this book, which is how a sense of place can be developed, how it can grow out of one's organic contact with the material of a place. And that's why this book is rather more different from that first book from Holy Land, which was more a meditation on how I became an adult. This is more a meditation about how I became part of this place.
How has Los Angeles changed? Because I think one of the things you write in the intro, which I think was obviously written after the pandemic began, and I believe after the uprisings began. Yes. You write in the intro that, quote, this is a book about a place Angelenos no longer live in. So I'd love to get a sense of you know, what is this LA that we no longer live in, and how is this new LA different?
Carolina, I'm not a nostalgist. I don't look to the past and wish I lived there. But I recognize that the Los Angeles I knew up until even a few months ago is not there anymore. We live in a environmentally, demographically, culturally, economically, almost in every dimension except politically, we live in a different city today. We live in a different region. When I talk about Los Angeles, I mean not just the city, but also the county and that great big thing of dreams and fears that we call Los Angeles. I think in all those dimensions, we live in a new place. And part of the concern this book has is how do we find a way through this new place? How do we make ourselves Angelenos in this changed city?
I think, you know, going back to that idea, because that is about exploring who we are to begin with, which is so much of what your book is about. Like, how do you move forward to whatever the new definition of Angeleno is without understanding what you were to begin with? And that's why this book is so fascinating to me. And I think why your work is interesting to me in general is that you have just always found a way of mapping these unseen forces that shape LA, you know, Spanish colonial laws, suburban zoning, geology, things that I never thought could be poetic. I almost failed out of geology class in college. And I think this book was so impactful to me because you pick the threads of some of LA's foundational myths. I think of the historic walk of the pobladores, the treaty of the Campo de Cahuenga, which was the informal agreement between the US and Mexico to cease hostilities during the Mexican-American War in California. And, you know, the story of how Helen Hunt Jackson's Ramona came to be. That is a fascinating chapter in the book. So I'd love to get a sense from you, what made you want to excavate some of these stories and I guess begin to pry them apart a little bit?
Exactly, Carolina. I wanted to delve into these stories because they reflect some of the foundational myths of Los Angeles. And yet when you begin, as you said, when you begin to pick them apart, the mythic qualities begin to evaporate and you begin to see that the parts of these stories don't necessarily mesh very well, or that many of them seem to be made out of nothing but wishes and dreams and not reflecting a material reality. And I wanted to use this book in part to be a way of a critically looking at the mythology that undergirds a lot of our mistaken understanding of Los Angeles. This book is many things, but it's an investigation. It's a critical analysis of some of the forces that make the city that we used to live in, and which will certainly linger in the city that we're now living in.
So looking at one of those stories, I was particularly compelled by the story of Helen Hunt Jackson's Ramona, which, you know, has just unleashed this torrent of cultural production, very famous book, novel that, you know, as you recount, and I had no idea about this story in the book, was really she wanted to create this socially aware book that would draw people's attention to issues of labor and the missions and colonialism in California, and it ended up being completely overlooked. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that story. Certainly. Like, tell us about what Ramona was, but also how that book did create this, like, what image did it create of ourselves as a city?
Well, just as you said, Carolina, Helen Hunt Jackson wanted to write a powerful, politically focused book that would do two things. It would draw attention to the plight of Native American and indigenous populations in Southern California that had been cruelly abandoned by the American occupiers of Southern California. And she wanted to celebrate the indigenous Latino culture, the Californio culture, that she thought represented a fit, dignified, romantic culture suitable for the landscapes, if you will, of Southern California. And she did this quite wonderfully. So wonderfully that her Anglo readers ignored her plea for indigenous rights and good treatment of indigenous populations, embraced the romance and the exoticism of Los Angeles, but basically stepped away from the situation of the Latino population, the California population, and left Anglo readers were left with only this wonderful vision of beautiful Southern California, of romantic Los Angeles, of a place that was a place only of dreams. And her project then utterly failed. It produced, as you said, an enormous amount of cultural production, invented tourism in Southern California to a great degree, created a lot of the tourist destinations of the early 20th century and well into my childhood, propelled the missions into a status of important places of memory in California, but completely failed in her other goals of indigenous rights and the treatment of the California population. Helen Hunt Jackson had a vision and it failed, but her romance lived on in thousands and thousands of ways.
And I think one of those is, you know, when we were moving out of the LA Times building to move to our new office in El Segundo, one of them was these fiestas, these popular fiestas that they would have in LA in the early 20th century, and some posters turned up from some of those with these very romantic and very Spanish, because, you know, the idea, I think, you know, as you know from early California, it was highlighting the Spanish over the Mexican. It was Spanish revival architecture. You know, let's kind of erase that Mexican past that we don't want to deal with, and these posters emerged. So it kind of, that book launched so many things when early cultural events in Los Angeles.
Exactly. In inventing a fantasy Spanish past in which the Spanish colonial period and the Mexican colonial period are slammed together and mixed up and turned into the days of the dawns, all sorts of festivals and fiestas. We Angelenos, having sort of internalized all of that, have lost an enormous amount of our past. We can't make real sense of who we are and where we are if we inhabit that fantasy Los Angeles. We need to inhabit the Los Angeles we have. And in fact, we need to be able to inhabit the Los Angeles that's coming.
So what are some of the, I know that your book examines some of these past myths, but are there present day myths about who we are that we like to take, that we like to tell ourselves, that you think might be ripe for picking next?
Yeah. One myth that we have in Southern California, generally in the big thing called Los Angeles, is we have no past. The myth is that the place was invented in 1950, and there's only a few remnant bits of the past here. It's not true. Indigenous people, the descendants of the Californios, they're all around us. Marks of the past are everywhere in Los Angeles. It's not a city that has completely erased all that came before. Another myth that we have is that, well, we don't have any nature here. And that's completely false. Nature is everywhere in Southern California. It penetrates the city at every point. I believe, as other writers who have come before me believe, is that our connection to nature in Los Angeles is in fact rather more intense than some other places. And for me, the presence of nature, even in my ordinary blue-collar working-class suburb of Lakewood, the presence of nature there is something that connects me to my neighbors. In fact, nature is what connects all Angelenos. That's one of the very few things that all of us share, is the nature of this place.
That we all live in this giant basin with these very large mountains around us. I always think that, to be in New York is to be surrounded by this architecture, by the man-made, to venerate sort of the man-made, whereas in LA, what's the biggest thing here? It's the mountains.
Exactly. You know?
So one of the sentences that really caught my eye, one day I will have a student and I'll assault them with sentences from this book when they walk in the door, like my teacher did. But one sentence that really caught my eye was, in a chapter where you're talking about, the city in the mid 19th century, LA, you say, you note that it consisted of a series of, ranchos, a native village, a mission, and a pueblo. And as you write, it was, quote, a collection of centers and edges. That really stuck in my head. How has that idea, I guess, shaped the landscape and psychology of the Los Angeles that exists today?
It has shaped it completely. Los Angeles began as a multipolar region, a multipolar city, if you will, with a sacred side in the San Gabriel Mission, a secular side or a government side in the Pueblo of Los Angeles, in the native village of Yangna, and in these oppositions, sacred, secular, Spanish, indigenous, we see already the way in which the structure of Los Angeles is being formed. When we think about Los Angeles today, we think of it having many centers and lots of edges to those centers. In 1781, it was already a place of many centers and edges. The other thing that we tend not to realize about that moment in history, that very early Los Angeles, is it wasn't utterly on the edge of nowhere, but even at the moment of its creation, it was tied into a global network. Up from Mexico, down from Northern California, eastward across the Pacific, and westward from the East Coast. Los Angeles has always been a globalized city, multipolar city, a city of many edges, but also a global city.
Why do you think that decentered nature of the city is so hard for folks to understand? Because I feel like that's one of the things that comes up every time an outsider writes about LA. It's like, oh, it has no center.
It doesn't have a conventional center, and we shouldn't worry about it not having conventional center. We should be attentive to the many centers and try to understand how they relate to one another. I don't think of Los Angeles as a collection of islands, each one of them remote and disconnected from the others. I think of Los Angeles as a collection of steps along the way, stations along a rail line or subway stops along a subway. We live in a different kind of city. It's not unique. Other cities are somewhat the same. It's not so exceptional as to make Los Angeles unavailable as an object lesson, but we are a different city.
I think I always think of it, I've thought of it for a long time in the terms of like technology and the postmodern, like a distributed network, that yeah. There's not like a central mainframe where everything goes through. Instead, it's one network connecting to another to another. You know, like in the old days of Napster, when you could download music from somebody else's computer, this idea that nothing went through a central node, instead it was people connecting with each other. That's the way I've always kind of drawn the picture of Los Angeles in my head.
That's probably a much more contemporary vision than mine.
I think they fit together nicely.
But I would want to emphasize that all of these centers cannot persist simply as isolated islands. Far too many Angelenos live in one place, drive through a nowhere of the freeway system, and end up at a second place, and they don't see the connective tissue between the two locations. So part of what this book is about is about the virtue of walking. It's about getting closer to the landscape as it is, rather than seeing it as a series of disconnected nodes joined by the nowhere of a freeway system. I, as you might know, may know, I am not able to drive. I have never really driven. And my encounter with my own place here in Lakewood has informed how I see a sense of place being developed. And so a large part of this book is not so much about politics or history of Los Angeles. A large part of this book is about how does someone evolve a sense of place? What are the materials of a sense of place? What's the ordinary stuff of everyday life that can be given life by attention and attunement, turning to and seeing, listening, tasting, touching, using all of one's senses to make the ordinary and the everyday come alive. And that's what I hope would be the ultimate lesson of this book. Not so much that you know how Helen Hunt Jackson or the Pico family lived in the 19th century, but how you yourself might evolve a sense of place wherever you might be. Mm-hmm. With my own life, yeah.
This intimacy with the landscape.
Precisely.
So early on in the book, you know, going back to this idea about how we are perceived by outsiders, you have this great paragraph, which I take as a little bit of New York Times style section shade, in which you write, "Los Angeles, more than any other city in the West, grabs you by the arm, nearly by the throat, and insists you hear another explanation of itself. To the readers of its popular literature after 1900, Los Angeles must have seemed like a city of compulsive memoirists who want you to know why they came here, what they found when they did, and if they stayed or left." That does not seem to have stopped.
No, it has not. And I'm guilty of it too.
Well, you're from here, so I think you get a pass and you study the history. But I'd love to understand why does this place generate that compulsion? And what advice do you have to writers coming in from the outside to write about this?
Oh, well, that's a tougher
two-parter.
a tougher challenge. But the why is pretty clear. Los Angeles has always seemed like an anomaly to people who come, and I hate to characterize them this way, but people who come from the East. And for me, the East Coast begins just on the other side of the Colorado River. The anomaly of Los Angeles doesn't look like the places they are familiar with, doesn't run that way. Its cultures are mixed and mingled and hybridized in ways that are different from other places. Originally in the 19th and early 20th century, it was rather exotic in terms of its climate and the way it looked in the built environment. So travelers here felt the need to explain what they were experiencing in this new anomalous, exotic place. And there was a huge market for knowing more about it because Los Angeles, Southern California was an enormously successful lifestyle product sold all over the world, beginning with the Helen Hunt Jackson's Ramona. Now, what should writers do today? Well, you could behave like Rainer Banham, who came from England to write about Los Angeles, and he said he learned to drive in order to read Los Angeles in the original. Or you could do what I've done, which is pace its miles, footfall after footfall, on dead level concrete of its sidewalks, a lot of which need a good deal of repair.
Yes.
And you can encounter a place not from an altitude of 5,000 feet, which is how often the city is described, but you can encounter the city as a texture of experiences that occur at a human pace and which allow those experiences to impinge on you, and if you're lucky and attentive and attuned, they can transform you. And that process of transformation, I think, is acquiring a sense of place. So if you want to really write about Los Angeles and not be a tourist or a perpetual tourist, even if you live here, it's essential that you have a touching experience, an experience where the place actually touches you. And you don't get that in a car going 20 miles an hour on the freeway.
Exactly. I did many years ago, I trained for a half marathon, and we would do our long runs in different neighborhoods every week. And that's also, that for me was such a lesson in you just talking about LA as a great naturescape.
Yes.
You really begin to understand the contours of the geography of the foothills and the flats and, you know, the basin there. And each experience has different air and slightly different vegetation and different styles of architecture. And just seeing it, you know, running like 9 miles through Compton, you're going to see a lot more than if you just drive through.
Precisely the case. Then you begin to learn that the multiple ecologies of the Los Angeles region, and the micro ecologies that you find from neighborhood to neighborhood, just as you say, the built environment is somewhat different. The natural environment is different. The sounds, the sort of terroir of the place is different from neighborhood to neighborhood. And if we don't generally get a lot of that internalized, we become rather disconnected and alienated from where we live. That's why I think Jonathan Gold was such a wonderful ambassador for Los Angeles, because he said, you have to dine on Los Angeles. You have to put it in your stomach or taste it in your mouth and put it in your stomach. And then you begin to understand more about how rich and diverse and powerful this place is in terms of the people who live here. You need to ingest Los Angeles, yes. Jonathan Gold said.
And he did.
And he absolutely did.
God bless him.
Absolutely.
And it's really interesting. It goes back to that idea of centers and edges, that to know one little center or one edge of Los Angeles is to not know Los Angeles. It's to know one center or one edge. Like, I think one of the things that always shapes that I, in terms of how I think about the city, is that, you know, an immigrant moves to New York and they become a New Yorker, whereas people move to Los Angeles and they become part of their neighborhood. And neighborhoods have different accents. They have different ways of speaking and dressing and food. And it is really interesting thing to think about these kind of like micro globalist neighborhoods that exist all over this basin.
But I do want to emphasize that though I write about Lakewood a lot, write locally about Los Angeles, though that's a much bigger thing, I think of myself not as someone who's just immersed in a particular place. I think of the local as a critical tool. I think of critical localism, critical regionalism, using the local to interrogate the global and to pry apart some of the apparent truths of globalization. I think the local can be a powerful lens to see the larger world around us, not merely a comforting harborage for a weary soul like mine, but a way of critically looking at how the world actually works. Local reaches out to the global.
Exactly. The good and the bad.
Yes, the good and the bad.
The good and the bad. Speaking of bad, I have a question about the LA Times, the paper. I'm just making a funny transition there. Just kidding, LA Times editors. you have a chapter in the book about the union bombing of the LA Times in 1910. And for those who don't know about that episode, it was when a group of militants with ties to an iron workers union had carried out a campaign of bombings against anti-union strongholds, of which the LA Times was a very high profile one. General Otis was no friend to unions. And, you know, just thinking about that history and in the wake of the uprisings, you know, the Times is at this moment of introspection about the paper's role in so many unsavory historic episodes in LA, you know, whether it was serving as a shield for the hijacking of water from the Owens Valley or, you know, instigating a spurring on the Zoot Suit riots, you know, being caught really flat-footed in terms of the uprising in Watts in 1965, really not having staff that understood the neighborhood or understood what Black people in this country and in Los Angeles face. So I'd love to get a sense from you. I know that the LA Times legacy is large, but you know, what do you think its most significant legacy has been, for good or for bad? And where should we be looking moving forward?
Well, you know, Carolina, its greatest legacy, and you can take this either as good or bad, I'm going to withhold judgment at the moment about that, is that the Los Angeles Times and its owners and those who were part of its circles of power sold Los Angeles into existence, sold Southern California into existence. They created the city of power and wealth and ambition and aspiration that we've been living in. They did it for profit. They did it for power. They did it to aggrandize their idea of Anglo ascendancy in the wilderness, that so-called, of Southern California. And they made this place out of an act of will. You can take that any way you wish. I live here not because my parents were lured here by the blandishments of General Otis and Harry Chandler, but they came here to a place that Chandler and Otis and their confreres put together from the late 19th century onward. And here we are.
And I think those are the threads that we are currently picking apart right now.
Precisely. Now, where the paper is going, I have been a lifelong reader of the Los Angeles Times and have been very fortunate, and I'm enormously grateful to have written for the LA Times as a book reviewer and as an occasional political commentator. That was one of my highest ambitions, to have my name on a piece in the Los Angeles Times, and I'm enormously grateful to the editors who did then and have still welcomed me into its pages. But print media is a difficult business right now, and I'm not sure where we can expect it to go. Mm.
I think for us internally, it's also been thinking about, you know, the Chandlers and General Otis did think of the readership as a white readership. You know, it was their development of the great white spot, quote unquote. Yep. Like, that's how they thought of Los Angeles. And it has been really fascinating to be within the paper at this time, thinking about who our reader is now. How are we serving them? How are we telling these stories? You know, how are we creating these narratives that are going to be read you know, be picked apart by the Don Waldies of the future. It's going to pull at our threads. and it's really interesting to think about. We do find ourselves at this kind of tipping point. I think about, you know, the anniversary of the Chicano moratorium coming next week. And, you know, we're doing this giant package related to it. And I think for the first time ever has this battery of Latino reporters working on it.
Exactly. Yeah, the paper is so important to what Los Angeles has been that the way in which the paper is introspectively regarding itself is very important to where Los Angeles will be. I think the paper can carry the same burden of bringing Los Angeles to life that it had when Otis and Chandler ran it, but in a very different way. The paper does have a historic role in explaining Los Angeles to itself, and that's what interests me.
Well, hopefully we'll be around for a while longer to do it.
Indeed.
So I wanted to turn this around before we turn to our viewer questions, to your writing process, because you are, like I said, you make poetry out of geology and colonial zoning law. I think I missed those chapters when I was in school because I wasn't paying attention. And so I'd love to know a little bit about your process. Like, do you write in the morning, in the evening, on a computer? Like, how do you generate your ideas? Like, how do you come to the act of making the essays that you make?
Well, it's a couple of very prosaic ways. I have always composed on a machine. So I learned to type badly when I was about 9 or 10. And so transitioned to computer screens without much difficulty. And so I'm used to using that kind of technology to assemble my thoughts. I'm not a legal pad and ballpoint pen writer. That's one thing. I am a walker, as I said earlier, and a lot of my writing reflects the rhythms of someone walking. I come up with sentences and phrases at the pace of, now considerably slower pace, of a guy who's walked miles every day to and from work and the usual business of life. And I have a magpie's kind of brain. I just remember a few disconnected facts that sort of gel or percolate or ferment or whatever you want to call it in my increasingly slower working brain. And I see connections that perhaps might not be seen by others. And language, the language I use to make those connections is very, very important to me. I am convinced that the musicality of language is as important often as the sense in the language. I look for that musicality too.
Do you read a lot of poetry? I mean, or are there other writers that have served as, not necessarily as folks you would copy, because I know that writing doesn't work in that way, but I think who would serve as general points of inspiration? Like, who's on the Waldy, the most read on the Waldy bookshelf?
Well, you can put John McPhee up there. A very important writer who has dealt with some of the same tough, how do you write about this in a way that ordinary people would find interesting? Stephen Jay Gould, who wrote on science topics, who did much the same for his interest in biology and paleontology and the history of life. And many of his pieces were not just about the subject matter of a snail or a dinosaur. It was about how someone could describe that and how people in the past did describe it. It was a lot of his writing was about how we come to understand something by encountering it, touching it, feeling it, tasting it, making it part of us. It was about sort of affective science. And I have a wonderful friend who's been part of my writing life since 1970, really. His name is Gary Young. He's a printer and a poet and a teacher in Santa Cruz, and who is a fabulous prose poet. And if there's anything good about the language in Holy Land, it's due to him, because he worked with me through that book's composition. Literally every single word passed through his hands many, many times. And I learned a great deal from him as a writer. And if there is prose poetry, anything that I have written since, you can blame him.
Okay, we know who to hold responsible.
You do indeed.
So I wanted to start turning over to some of the questions that we're getting from our audience. Thank you again to everyone who has turned out tonight via Zoom. It'd be nice to be in a room together, but alas. And the first question is from an anonymous participant who asks, how do you envision the future of the Los Angeles River? Do you think the mayor's current panel is focused too much on development versus natural revitalization for park-starved LA?
I'm very concerned in the way that our reader or our watcher frames it. It is the besetting original sin of Los Angeles is selling off the place and not leaving anything behind for the rest of us. Privatization of the natural sphere in Los Angeles has been criminal. And I worry about those issues with the development of the river. I deal with some of that in the book. The plans for a river for all of us are exciting and marvelous, and the dollars are there to do a good job. But it would be hateful if that better looking, more usable river was walled off from the rest of us by gated and guarded development.
Thanks, Don. Moving on to the next question, which is very topical, related to monuments. I grew up learning that Junipero Serra was a great man for establishing missions throughout California. Now we are told that he is a criminal for wiping out the Native American population. Serra's statues have been torn down and been defaced. Can you tell us the true story of Junipero Serra?
Oh, heavens.
You got 5 minutes.
Well, there is a fascinating debate underway in many forms of media. Some of them are specifically Catholic publications, which are seriously wrestling with what we should think about Serra's legacy. It is highly conflicted. It does not have any easy answers. There are those in the indigenous community who are glad the statues have been taken down. There are those in the indigenous community who regret seeing them being taken down. My view is that we need to explore together more deeply the legacy of the Spanish colonial period in Southern California, or in California generally. And there are gestures that can be made. Maybe taking the statues down is the right gesture. I'm not sure. But I do know that the way forward to understand where we came from is to together listen to each other's voices, talk about that past and how it impinges upon our lives today.
I wanted to ask a quick follow-up question to that, which is, you know, we are in this moment in which we are, you know, old monuments are coming down and people are talking about putting new ones up. And I recently did a big story about it for the Times and asked a number of people, what is the monument that you would like to see built in LA? So I wanted to put that question to you. What piece of Los Angeles history has not been adequately memorialized in our landscape?
There are several. One that comes immediately to mind is the role of the Asian community, specifically the Chinese community, in the making of Los Angeles, the making of Southern California, indeed the making of the West, and the horrific treatment that Asians received in Los Angeles, particularly the Chinese massacre of 1871. that's one area that needs to be better remembered. Another is the whole notion that the Southern California was invented for people who look like me. And we really do need to have monuments to the people of color who were principally responsible for making this place a place in the 19th century and into the 20th century. So I would want a monument to the men and women of color who put their backs and their hands into the building of Los Angeles. And I would wish that we had a monument to, well, a monument to the kinds of places that Lakewood is. Who knows? When Los Angeles was a haven for tens of thousands of young working men and women who were able to make decent, dignified lives living here in their little houses on little lots in neighborhoods like mine in Lakewood. I'd honor them too, even though sadly that dignified, honest life was denied to so many other people, so many other people of color.
Thanks for that. I feel like we're going to keep the monument designers busy. I think the Chinese massacre has come up again and again as an area of history that is not enough studied, that is quite unknown, and that has not, there's a plaque by the Chinese American Museum in downtown, but that's it. And it was this eruption of brutal, brutal violence against Chinese people in the 19th century. Going to the next question I have, this is a great question. I'm not sure who asked it, but I will ask it. It says, if you had a time machine dialed to Los Angeles, when would you go and why?
Ah, very interesting question.
Yeah.
Well, I think Los Angeles around any time between 1900 and 1918 would have been a very interesting town to go to. It would have been dustier and slower, but it wouldn't be kind of a good slowness. It would have been sunnier and more open. It would have been a great deal, much more rural. And it would have been a place where you could see people building a new culture, a specifically Southern California lifestyle in this area. That would have been fun to see people making from that moment Los Angeles from the ground up. It would have been exciting, actually.
And it would have been easier to walk around, that's for sure.
Well, the risks of being run over were a little bit less, but there was still a fair amount of traffic accidents, even in the almost first car era of Los Angeles.
And probably a good deal of bar brawls. Like, LA has quite the history. So, you know, on that idea of walking, it brings me to the next question, which someone says, hurrah for the virtue of walking. So you have a fan out there. We so seldom talk about LA as a walkable city. Please say more about walking in LA. Do you include Lakewood as part of Los Angeles?
Oh, well, I live in Lakewood. Actually, what I should say is my home is in Lakewood, but I live in Los Angeles. There are at least three things that can be called Los Angeles. There's the city itself, many hundreds of square miles, many millions of residents. Then there's the county of Los Angeles, many more hundreds of square miles, many more millions of residents. And then there is the big thing, that kind of borderless space of dreams and fears that we call Los Angeles too, that many, many, many more people live in. I used to say, if you've ever seen a movie, you've lived part of your life in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. My home is in Lakewood, I live in Los Angeles. Now, to speak of walking, there are tremendous walks in Los Angeles, and there are plenty of ways to learn about them. Some of them are more demanding than others. There's a lot of staircases to go up and down in certain parts of the city. But for the most part, Los Angeles reveals itself at a walker's pace in ways that, drivers are completely unaware. It is, there is in fact, a separate city, the driver's city and the walker's city. And I would strongly advocate that the drivers become walkers at least part-time in order to encounter the city on its own terms.
I think, you know, it's interesting that for a quick follow-up on that, the pandemic has brought a lot more people out walking. You know, streets have been made, quote-unquote, slow streets to allow children greater space to play. Cycling, I feel like this moment, given the sort of lack of access to outdoor space in a lot of parts of Los Angeles, has had people thinking about that. How has the pandemic changed your routines? Like, and how, what maybe odd habits have you taken on just to make it through? I think we all have cultivated a few odd habits during this time.
Well, I, as a lifelong non-driver, I was very dependent upon public transit, and buses and trains and subways were a big part of my life. I could connect with the larger Los Angeles from my home without too much difficulty, although it's sometimes time consuming. Well, I don't drive, I'm not riding the buses or the trains or the subway now. So that the pandemic has greatly shrunk, compressed my world. That's a loss. I wish it were otherwise. I'm missing out on a lot of good things. And it's distressing. I've tried to find more ways of connecting here in my own community. I now meet a great many more of my neighbors who are out walking their dogs. There's going to be a large number of very healthy dogs at the end of all of this.
No, right?
You know, they walk twice a day. And that's been kind of a delight. I mean, I know them sort of in passing because have lived in my neighborhood for years, but now I'm actually encountering them on the street and chatting with them while their dogs leap around my knees. And and that's a good thing. Suddenly, a relatively small town like Lakewood becomes even more like a small town where people stop each other on the street and have a conversation. That's a very fine thing, I think. And that may be an odd habit for Angelinos, but I'm willing to pick it up.
I'll take it. It's true. I have gotten to know people better. I know that we are starting to run slow on time, so we have time for maybe two more questions. One of the questions that came up is, how do you think that gentrification is affecting the culture of Los Angeles, and how can we fight to keep Angelinos in the city as housing prices drive many of us out of the city we love?
This is, again, one of the intractable questions of the current situation. Gentrification is something that has worn away living, thriving, real communities, and at times has left behind a kind of synthetic community, which has no relationship to the history of the place, and does very little to bind those who live there together. I'm not sure if there is a tool in the toolkit of local government that would have a powerful effect on gentrification. I think we need to keep pressure on political officials and those who represent us to prevent gentrification from becoming a steamroller that wipes out neighborhoods and leaves behind, as I say, a somewhat synthetic idea of community.
Mm-hmm. And one that is like a gentrified neighborhood anywhere else. Like,
exactly.
Very, very, the sameness is mind-boggling. Daniel asks, In my mind, popular culture, film, TV, pop music, and books has always had a primacy in selling the vision of Los Angeles to the rest of the world. Do you feel that popular culture, as fragmented as it is, can continue to put forward a unified vision of Los Angeles?
No, I don't think so. In fact, in a great deal of the writing about Los Angeles that's been produced in the last 20 years, although it purports to better understand Los Angeles, a good deal of it is literature that or writing or analysis that is focused on again on the dystopic Los Angeles. It was in the era of Otis and Chandler and their minions. Los Angeles was a utopia. It was a paradise. It was that place that you longed to be, and for many years now. There's a good deal of literature that suggests that Los Angeles is a place you don't want to be, and you shouldn't, and no place should be like it in the future. This is one of the problems of writing and talking about Los Angeles. It's either an unsatisfactory as heaven, and it's unsatisfactory as hell, and those polar exceptional qualities are not very helpful in talking about Los Angeles. It's neither paradise nor hell. It is. Well, where we live, actually.
So it's kind of a purgatory. We're in between, is that?
No. We won't do that one either. No, it is a place of sacred ordinariness.
Sacred ordinariness. I think on that note, I am going to bring David Kippen back, because I think he wanted to say a few words before we wrap things up. I don't know. Do we have David on the line? It's no fun unless there's like that Zoom delay. Uh-huh. Oh, there he is.
Yes, indeed I am. God, sir. That was good. Boy, that was good. Hi again, everybody. I have a quick autocorrect. The LA Times was founded in 1881, not the 1860s, like I stupidly said before. I'm so ashamed, and none of you called me on it, so I'm ashamed of all of you, too. Also,
I'm just polite. Come on.
I have no idea. I just worked there.
Also, nobody asked me, but I love the question about creating new monuments in L.A. I won't natter on with my plan to rename all the bridges over the river that have boring names like the First Street Bridge and the Fourth Street Bridge. But Carolina mentioned the bridge over Hoover, just west of downtown. That bridge, like so much of the city around us, was built during the Depression with New Deal WPA labor. If we could christen that bridge the WPA Bridge, now especially, it would make me very, very happy. End of sermon. Thank you all for tuning in. Please, if you haven't already, become a member by visiting lfla.org/support. You can still purchase DJ Waldie's Becoming Los Angeles from the library store through the link in the chat. If you're running low on bathroom reading, you can even purchase my book, Dear Los Angeles, The City in Diaries and Letters, through the library store link too. The library looks forward to seeing you all online again for our upcoming conversations, and also in person soon, or I'm going to lose my mind. The librarians miss us, and heaven knows we miss them. Thanks, everybody, and good night.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.